Dave, good evening.
Hey, Stillman Wagstaff, how you doing?
Dave, I'm doing fantastic. It's the midsummer here. August has come. It's my birth month. Nothing could make this better.
Steele, I was just telling you this before we started recording, but there's one thing that can make anybody's life better. That is when your medical provider does a little bit of extra research and sees that he doesn't necessarily have to do the hernia check on you for a sports physical. People love it. As soon as you say you're not going to have to drop your pants this time, the kids, like, suddenly they'll make eye contact. They start talking to you. It's amazing.
It is a sports physical season, and I'm glad that you're representing Snowflake and keeping those kids safe for full contact football.
Somebody's got to do it, and it's a rite of passage I think most of us have gone through, but I never played football still. I wasn't big enough.
If you want to talk about world-class football players, Dave, we are really lucky to have a very special guest on our show. Liz Feaser was a three-time All-State defensive back in high school. Liz,
wow.
Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
So good. So glad to finally have you on. Liz and I go way back to Boise, Idaho, Dave.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I actually knew Jack Bangeter. It was up for debate until he was on your show, but I can say that I actually know him and that he's real.
Yeah, she can confirm he's a real person that predates my existence.
I was about to ask that question. I'm so happy.
Yeah.
We're getting a lot of Boise the last couple of weeks. This is great.
It's the jewel of the Intermountain West.
Yeah. That's on the sign outside of town. I've seen it. It's beautiful.
City of trees, Dave. Come on. It's the city of trees. Well, Dave, the thing that I really wanted to talk to you about, and you, Liz, is just the buzz, the political excitement that's in the air. So last week, we had the second of the party conventions. We've heard the Republican National Convention. We've heard the Democratic National Convention. And we have two really outstanding candidates for president of the United States that the parties have put forward. But even more than that, we heard from the people who make both of those parties great. And I wanted to know whether either of you had some, like, best of or greatest hits from either of the conventions, because I was unable to watch them on television. So I missed out.
Steele, you know I'm a huge television fan. I love it. Probably two of my top 10 shows of all time, Happy Days, Charles in Charge. And if you want to speak to me, all you got to do is you get Scott Baio on the stage. So I really appreciate that Trump called him up, got him to just preach some gospel. And the guy just, he knows what's going on. He's great.
Yeah, I was impressed, because it's a big move when you can get Scott Baio, very much man of the moment, in the zeitgeist. His political opinions, I think, are really well respected in all the insider circles that I know of. And so I'm glad that he was able to get up on the national stage and remind people just what his credentials are for, you know, bringing out the vote, rocking the vote among Republicans.
Yeah, we tried to book him for this podcast, and he of this month, he only had 30 of the days available. Like, it was limited.
Yeah, it was tough to even get an appointment with him.
Yeah, I'm just entertained. If you wheel out an 80 celebrity at your convention, like, things might not be going as planned. Things aren't great for you.
I don't know, Liz. You had a pretty compelling moment from the Republican National Convention that I missed, but really wished that I had been able to catch.
Oh, yeah. Well, aside from, you know, wanting to get Scott Baio to weigh in on the situation and hear what he and, what's his name, Antonio Sabato Jr. had to say about what's going on.
Yeah, what I want to know is, where was Antonio Sabato Sr. in all of this?
Political hard hitters, man. No, I watched part of each convention on TV. Of course, saw some of the great speeches in the DNC. But I think my best of moment personally was, there was a tweet that came out from somebody, and I can't remember his name, but he tweeted out from the Republican National Convention that there were no cargo shorts allowed in the convention hall, and that was a real blow.
Was the subtext like that they were tweeting from just outside the convention hall because they had been banned?
I don't know. I don't know if he was in cargo shorts and was summarily dismissed. I don't know the circumstances, but I looked at it and I thought, you know, I agree with that. And I think that maybe the only thing I agree with is going on.
Maybe I need to take a closer look at the Republican Party platform. There might be something in there after all for me.
This seems like a huge mistake if you're trying to get the Dave Matthews Band followers and the Phish fans on board with your political party. You're losing a huge percentage of the vote right there.
Right. That kind of key post-Gen X, pre-millennial demographic that Steele and I at least fall into were cargo shorts, man. Those were a big part of sartorial zeitgeist in our high school days anyway.
I don't know why you're talking about this as if it were past tense, Liz.
You know what?
I feel a little betrayed.
This is timely. So that Wall Street Journal article that you sent me, it's been getting some traction on the Facebook.
It's the number two most shared Wall Street Journal article of the last week, just behind this Iranian deal that Obama made for $400 million. So it's
right?
Like neck
I had
neck.
No idea how contentious cargo shorts were, but the guys, man, some of you guys just are not willing to give those things up.
Well, I don't know. My favorite detail from that story was the story about Michael Jordan, where he's at a golf resort in Miami, and someone comes up to him and says, "Excuse me, Mr. Jordan, you need to either leave the golf course or change out of those cargo shorts. They're not permitted on the golf course." And he refused to leave. He said, "No, I'm wearing these." But apparently, like, it's like he violated the dress code at some Miami golf course by wearing his cargo shorts. And that would be something. I don't know why TMZ exists if not to capture the cell phone video footage of that interaction.
You heard it here first, guys. If Michael Jordan's getting denied, take off the cargo shorts.
Yeah.
No way. You got to stand for something. Jordan stood up to the golf course. I'm standing up to Trump in this one area. The rest of his platform is great, but cargo shorts, I can't vote for him now.
That was the straw that broke the camel's back, huh?
That's it.
Dave, you sent me a message along these lines, but not having watched either of the conventions, but read the transcript of a bunch of the speeches and just seeing who the list of speakers were, the RNC was just an absolute clown circus this year. And the Democrats delivered like real adult human beings. And I'm not an impartial observer, but it's just hard for me to look at those two and say, like, you know what? Good job, two-party system. You really delivered two interesting, potentially compelling choices. It was just, the difference was so stark this year for me.
Gosh, I'm worried that after this year we're down to a one-party system. Like, how can you take the Republic? And I before this, I'm an independent. I was not on Hillary's bandwagon, but just the conventions further cement it. And yeah, the speeches at the Democratic National Convention were just like professional speeches that you could listen to and watch without just being like, what the hell's going on right now?
The Obamas were both terrific. I loved Joe Biden was one of my legit favorite politicians when I lived and worked in D.C. And he got a little crusty and, you know, attitude on him. I mean, it was just a fun event all around.
But the one speech that I genuinely thought was very moving, and there's been some controversy afterwards, is Khazir Khan.
So moving.
The father of the soldier that died in Iraq. They were immigrants and Muslim immigrants, so the very kind of people that Donald Trump doesn't want coming to the country, and his son sacrificed his life for our country, and just the speech that man gave was really moving, and I think very valid. Just excellent criticism and, beautiful.
So I come from a military family, and I've never had particularly, like, warm or strong feelings for the military or for nationalism or things. But the part of the speech where he talked about if you go to the military cemetery at Arlington and you look at the religion of the soldiers there, he says, you know, there's Muslims, there's Christians, there's Jews, there's Hindus, there's people of all ethnicities, all faiths, all races, both gender, like, that was profoundly moving. Like, I think that spoke to, like, our noble ideals and pulling the Constitution out was like a total baller move. And and the question about like, what have you sacrificed for this country? And his response was just so classless. It was just, that for me was a real defining moment that I imagine that we'll remember 10, 20 years from now in the looking back at this election cycle.
Yeah. Trump's response, it just highlights kind of sociopathic person he is. And it's unbelievable. You can't attack the mother of a soldier that's died. It's just crazy, like legitimately crazy. Someone needs to sit him down and just like, hey, we need to get you some antipsychotics or something. You're just insane right now, man.
I'm still waiting for Ashton Kutcher to pop out and tell us we're all punked.
Yeah. But this is the best long con of Ashton Kutcher's career.
Right? Right?
You know, I had not considered that, Liz. That's a really great trenchant observation. Well, enough about that. We don't usually talk politics too much in the show for obvious reasons, but we do have a legit interesting person to talk to. So let's switch tracks and let's talk about you, Liz. We have a little segment that we like to call Expert Testimony, where we get fun, interesting people on and just ask them a lot about their lives and about things that they're expert in. And usually we start with what the person does for a living as an adult. And so we wanted to start with you. I think one of the things you're really stand out in my mind for is the kind of interesting career choices you've made, Liz, and this life of travel that you've been able to kind of cultivate for yourself. But I want to start, what do you do for a living?
Sure. Well, first, I would probably use the word expert adult very loosely when I talk about myself, because I don't consider myself an adult yet. I suppose at almost 35, I probably should. For a living, I've been doing human resources and employee benefits work for over the last 10 years. Certainly didn't go to college to do that, just sort of came upon it. I majored in Spanish in undergrad and was recruited by a company in Boise that does kind of like medical insurance, different funding mechanisms involving that. And so I kind of got into employee benefits that way and then relocated to Seattle in 2010. Got into benefits consulting, relocated again to Austin in 2012, and kind of continued along that path for the last 4 or so years until my most recent, I guess, flirtation with a professional sabbatical that was prematurely ended. So
the first immediate follow-up question I have is, I feel like HR is the abbreviation that everybody immediately knows. Oh yeah, HR, human resources, we know what it is. But I don't feel like I know anybody who knows what it is. Like, we know what it means, but we don't know what it means. What in the world does it mean when someone says, yo, I'm in human resources?
Right. No, I understand your confusion, and I can understand how it can just kind of seem like this construct that, like Jack Bangor, may or may not exist. I mean, human resources has different arms, different areas that you can specialize in. I, in particular, am in compensation and benefits, where I guess is more of like the concrete things that you think of, the things that most directly affect you, your paycheck and your benefits. Other areas would, I guess, be employee relations, things if
making people happy happens in the workplace and stuff.
Exactly. Organizational management, kind of the more boring stuff where, you know, HR kind of acts as a business partner to different arms of an organization to consult on things like hiring and firing and structural management, that kind of thing.
So when you apply for and take new jobs, do you like read all the fine print of the benefits and like haggle and negotiate? Is that like something you immediately look for? Or is it just like you're like in the rest of us, this is what you do for a living, but it's like not an obsession?
I mean, when I look at a new job, of course, I'm looking at the benefits and, you know all the ins and outs of what I do. A lot of times benefits themselves aren't negotiable, but things like PTO, you know, your time off. Mm-hmm. Pretty much anything's negotiable, except for things like, you know, your medical plan.
So Liz, in the 90s, you guys remember Dilbert was just huge? You remember the comic strip?
Of course.
So the HR person in Dilbert was the cat, and he's just like this evil cat that just enjoyed, essentially he enjoyed taking benefits away from people, I think. And that was kind of what HR was looked at then. Is that still kind of how people feel? Is that still like a movement in HR? You're just constantly restricting benefits, or have things changed? Is the cat no longer evil?
I think, you know, it's too bad that a lot of people probably do think of HR and think of HR as a construct as the cat, you know, the kind of killjoys that come in and take things away and tell people not to have fun. But I mean, I don't think that's the case. I got into HR and benefits because I genuinely like working with people and teaching people how to use the benefits that are there for them to use. And so I think Austin's a different market talking about benefits just because it's such a tech heavy place where you get all kinds of crazy benefits, you know, catered lunches and snacks and all sorts of perks here and there that every other company is trying to one up the other one. In terms of those,
it sounds kind of fun. Like you're adding things on. You're like, oh well, there's a third floating ping pong table in an anti-gravity room. But I don't know. I mean, you might already have that where you work.
Right. Well, we have. Yeah. I'll see your ping pong table and raise you a zip line that goes from the window of our office into the bar that's next door.
So, with what you do with HR, is it primarily like a soft skills human profession, or is it like a math and technical side? I mean, like, do you have to develop some kind of quantitative business analysis stuff, or is this more of a human being job?
Yeah, well, I think that's what I like about HR is it really is a mix of both, especially in compensation and benefits. You do have to have a pretty strong analytic side and be able to tell a story with the data, but as you're in human resources, especially touching things like benefits and employee relations, I mean, these are highly sensitive things that people talk about, you know, their health, their money, working with other people. Those are highly sensitive topics. And so you have to be, you know, very soft skills driven. You have to be a people person.
So you were describing a little bit of like a career trajectory and some of the places that you've lived. And you started school in Boise. You went to college in Oregon. You moved to Seattle, to Austin, went to Columbia. Each of these places sounds like maybe top 10 in North America, certainly, maybe in like the Western Hemisphere. How did you pick these places, and what's been like your rationale for where you live and how you do that?
I guess I should start. So my family actually moved to Boise right before I started high school. So I actually grew up in Houston, Texas. It's a rough move. I mean, when you're that age, it's a rough age anyway. And so to have been uprooted and moved, it was a rough couple of years. But I think what it gave me an appreciation for was the drive to get up and move if you're not happy where you live. Huh. And not be afraid to start over. And so when I was living in Boise for the second time, this would be post-undergrad, I was there for about 6 years after coming back from Oregon. And I think I'd known for a while, for a few years anyway, that I liked Boise. Obviously, it's a great place to raise a family. It's a great place in general. And I feel like I'd kind of outgrown it. And when you live in Boise and you're looking for a bigger place to live, there are three places that people kind of naturally think of first: Salt Lake, Portland, Seattle. Those are kind of the big three that are geographically the closest. Seattle had been on my list for a while. I had friends there. I liked it there. And so I made the big move in the fall of 2010 by myself to Seattle.
So hold on a second. The other week we had a guy from Boise. Steele, you grew up in Boise, Liz from Boise, and somehow I haven't asked anybody a Built to Spill related question. You guys lived in Boise. Built to Spill was big back then. Is Built to Spill a part of your life? Is this a part of your view of society and music? Or do you guys not care and are you terrible people?
I personally am Built to Spill agnostic, which is probably, I know.
Oh, no.
I'm aware of them. I'm aware that they're good. I've even seen them live once or twice for free in like small parks in Boise where they've played shows.
That's
I'm just not
awesome,
a, I'm just not a super fan, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I feel really similarly. I feel super similarly. I knew that I was supposed to like Built to Spill a lot because they're like Boise music royalty. And at the Boise Public Library, they had a bunch of Built to Spill old record CDs. So I checked them all out in high school and used to listen to it a lot. But I just like Doug Marsh might be a guitar legend, but his voice is atrocious.
It's beautiful. It's so beloved. No, I really
Jack likes
him
a lot more than me and Liz probably.
I should have brought it up with Jack. I blew it. I really like, I liked him more probably 10 years ago. I don't listen to him that much anymore, but when I was like 25, like I built a spill. I loved it. I thought they were the best. But now we can continue on with the rest of the discussion, but we can't mention Boise that many times without talking about Built a Spill.
Good. Just, thanks for saving us here. We almost made a terrible mistake.
I know.
Well, Liz, I was going to ask you, so I'm guessing a lot of our listeners are at various stages of our life, but like you had 6 years as an adult post-college in one city, and then you decided to go somewhere else. What kind of emotional state were you in ahead of time? Were you nervous about that? Were you anxious? And then you've done it again a couple more times. That seems a little bit unusual, and if you're not somebody that's in the military or has like a family or medical reason to go somewhere, it seems a little unusual or adventurous to me, and I want to understand your mindset in that.
I think, well, aside from the move from Houston to Boise before high school, I had chosen where I went for undergrad, the University of Oregon, go Ducks, partially based on the fact that nobody else from our high school was going there. And even though it's a big school and logically I probably would rarely have run into anybody I knew, it really made me happy to know that I was the only one going and that it would truly be kind of a starting over thing. Huh. So having done that, I think in college and then done, you know, being moved at age 14 before then kind of set the stage for not being afraid to start over and getting excited about the prospect of what's to come when you do start over. I think maybe it had been a while, you know, me being in Boise for 6 years, kind of doing the same thing, seeing the same people. I was ready for a change. I was ready for a bigger city, more opportunity. So at the time, I was really excited. I was working full time in benefits. I'd taken another part time job to kind of save some more money and make the move, and moved out of my apartment. And actually, my last night in Boise, I stayed at Heidi Bangerter's house.
You did?
I did. Yeah. She hosted me for the night because I had to be out of my apartment. And so I got to stay at her house with my Honda Civic full of everything I could put in there and drove to Seattle the next day. So.
Yeah, those days when you could fit everything you owned in your Honda Civic. I did that move several times. Now it's like a true trucks. But yeah, I think moving's a really interesting time. It's an opportunity for change. Yeah, like going to college for the first time, you're able to kind of explore, open yourself up. And I think every time you move, you get that opportunity. But it sounds like you recently had an opportunity that for change that went poorly. There was some type of fiasco. Can I hear about this?
Oh, yes. I decided probably late last year that I wanted to take just kind of a career sabbatical, take some time off, do some traveling, and just do something completely different for a while. And so I applied for a program to teach English abroad in Colombia. I'd heard great things about Colombia from my boyfriend, from other friends who'd been. They said, oh my gosh, you'll love it. It'll be great. So I applied, got in. March of this year, I quit my job. And then early June, I left. Went through the training in Bogota, which was fantastic. And then after a couple of weeks of training, they kind of took our cohort of 55 or so English teachers, and we were all dispersed to different areas within Colombia. Some places had, you know, a handful of people. I was actually the only one assigned to Barranquilla, which is on the Caribbean coast. And I have never been so hot and uncomfortable all my life. I have to say, I grew up in Houston, Texas, where it is like a swamp right now.
It's awful there. Yeah.
Baby used to live there?
Oh, yeah. It's the worst. You can't go outside right now.
I'm telling you, I will never complain about the Texas heat again.
Oh, no.
Surface of the sun. It was nuts. I didn't know heat and humidity like that existed.
The photo that you posted on your blog of you maybe on a beach or something, I was stunned. You looked like 10 degrees above uncomfortable.
I felt like I was dying. I felt like I was boiling from the inside out. And like I posted in my blog, just to kind of underscore my point about how hot it was, I at one point realized that I had gotten a yeast infection in my belly button. That is not a proud thing to admit. It's gross for me to say out loud, and it's even grosser and more embarrassing to try to explain to the drugstore in Spanish what exactly I thought was going on and what exactly I thought I might need for it. But apparently this is a fairly common occurrence.
Yeah, Dave, you treat that pretty often in Arizona? Dave's a nurse.
Yes. I saw it in the hospital all the time, but it was usually with people of a slightly different build than Liz, like morbidly obese people. Their skin folds would just be loaded with that stuff, but it was more understandable.
Yeah, it was like a physical symptom of the Caribbean coast of Colombia just rejecting me. Just saying, you do not need to be here.
So was that a hard decision to make?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I laugh about the heat and that experience and just sweating all the time. And that was certainly one facet of kind of what made it a less than positive experience. But I just felt very unsupported. The program I'd signed up for failed to let me know that I would be the only teacher assigned to that city. The class wouldn't start until almost a month after we had gotten to our assigned cities, that we would not have a break any longer than a 3-day weekend until December when the program ended. It just kind of was thing after thing of, oh, by the way, that I was thinking, you know, if I had known all these things,
bait and switch.
Yeah. So I decided, well, first I requested to be transferred to any other place that they needed, you know, that there was a need, and they denied my request. And so, yeah, they would rather lose a teacher than transfer
to
anywhere else. Yeah, I left the program, and so they canceled my visa. And so I had about a week in Medellin, which I loved. Medellin, Colombia, if you get a chance, great city.
And that's so, where the world-class cocaine comes from, I understand. The cocaine was anything else you want to confess on the show? We'll just block your voice out. We'll do one of those voices.
There it is.
Had a great time, surprisingly.
For an entire week. Yeah, if you that much cocaine, you don't have to sleep. It's great.
It's funny because obviously that's what we all, you know, think of Escobar and the history behind that. But you'd never know that 20 years ago it was the most dangerous city on the planet. Just the coolest city, just very and happy people, and just very modern and full of culture and just happy people. Colombians in general are very happy people, which I think we could learn something from that. Yeah. But Medellin I loved. I loved getting the chance to, well, not only Medellin, but Bogota and my time just kind of traveling around Colombia. I don't regret it for a minute. So I'm super glad that I went. Not so glad that it turned out the way it did, but ended up back home and back at it. So well, that's my story of my failed sabbatical.
I think that there's a genuine lesson there, which, you know, we don't normally talk about in America. I think sometimes it's okay and appropriate to give up.
Sunk costs, cutting your losses. Think of how different our life would be, Dave, if we had done it 3 months into our 2-year missions. Like, I mean, I'd be a happier man today.
Oh, jeez. Well, I dropped out of law school, like best thing I ever did. It felt like a terrible decision for a minute. And then as soon as it was done, I was like, this is awesome. And
I got a divorce after 6 years. It was the best decision I ever made. I don't say that flippantly. I mean, like, sometimes quitting is the hardest thing, but the best thing.
Yeah, and that was a tough lesson for me to learn, especially after, you know, all of my friends and family knew about this. I was all excited. Like you said, I had sunk several hundred of my own dollars to just get there and sign up for the program, et cetera. So it felt like, you know, a big loss and kind of a failure, but kind of learning to reframe that as choosing the importance of something else over this.
I can imagine there's a mix of, like, feeling like I failed and also like the choice that you made reflects a certain like self-respect, right? Like
totally.
I don't want to be treated this way and I won't be treated this way. So this is what I'm going to do. I don't know what kind of pressure the program put on you to feel that, but there's a kind of balancing there.
Right. And I think for as much as I joke about not being an adult and not feeling like an adult, I think this experience definitely made me realize that maybe I'm a grown up now and I'm used to, I'm used to my comforts and I'm used to, you know, the way I like things. And, you know, maybe 10 years ago when I was in college, staying in hostels and sleeping in sketchy conditions and just that kind of life. That was fine. That was cool. But, you know, we grow up.
Maturity can change you.
Yeah.
Well, Liz, I want to take you also back to college because this is something that I think is radical, that was distinctive about you, that I didn't really know. I don't think we knew each other well enough at the time. But one of your, I don't know if it's a hidden skill or a hidden talent, is an incredible sense of rhythm.
Well, I wouldn't call it incredible, but yeah, I've played drums and percussion since the sixth grade when we had to pick an instrument to play in band. You had to pick band, orchestra, or arts, music, and speech in sixth grade, I think it was. Uh-huh. And I knew I wanted to be in band, and I knew I wanted to play percussion.
Why? So, why were you drawn to percussion?
A friend of mine that I grew up with, actually a family friend who was a year older than me, had joined her junior high band and also played percussion. And so I think part of it was me kind of wanting to emulate her and be like her. And also there was kind of that added factor of wanting to be better than the boys. It was kind of a big,
Totally.
So Liz, important question. Have you been involved in marching band? And if so, why? And if so, further follow up, did you enjoy it?
You gotta let her answer the first question before you throw the
I got so many. I'm so interested.
I like the, if so, why?
and why did you like it?
Yeah, right. No, I was in marching band in high school, and then I did it again in college. It was actually it was a big driver for why I chose the University of Oregon. They have a great music school. The football team was starting to get good at that time, so the promise of getting some good trips and having good times was part of that whole decision. But it was the best thing I could have done. It really was like, especially in college, it's like being in a frat, but with other cool people
first thing you think of when you think marching band is cool people. Like,
right?
Hands down, first thing.
Dave, yeah. You're so stuck in stereotypes, man.
I know. That's why I have these questions.
Here's the proof. Did you ever go to band camp?
Oh, yes. Oh, band camp. Yes. If anybody else from the marching band, from Oregon Marching Band is listening to this, they'll know when I say the name Todd Zimbelman, the fear of God that strikes when that name talks. No,
was
band
he
camp
the Hollis Pinnock of the University of Oregon?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, he was a bit of a hard ass. We had it was tough band camp. It was like 9 in the morning to 9 at night, 6 days a week for 2 weeks before school started. So it was long days learning the show and learning everything.
What do people do in their downtime? How do the cool kids get down in band camp?
Practice. Wow. It seemed like during all of our lunch and dinner breaks, we would like wolf down food and water and just like practice our beats because like we'd have assignments during breaks. Like you learn this chunk of music, like memorize this by the time we return for this next chunk of rehearsal. So
it was pretty intense, pretty single-minded.
It was. And I think that's something that, not a lot of people know, especially about college marching band and, drum corps, which is kind of the more hardcore version of marching band.
Is that the drum-only marching band?
It's drums and bugles. It's drum and bugle corps, and it's a private entity that kids do during the summer. You can do it up to age 21, and if you ever get a chance, I know in Madison there's usually a show every year, but if you ever get a chance, go. It's fantastic.
So we live just around the corner from where the marching band practices, and we can hear them from our house, and we'll take – the kids always love to go down there and see the marching band practice, and it's pretty awesome. It's like this time of year starts happening a bit more. It's that season. You know, you hear it in the air, and it's fun.
Oh, yeah. It's summer.
So top halftime performance, do you have one that, like, still sticks with you or a show that you really like that you guys did?
Oh, man. And this is why, if anybody from marching band listens to this, they'll probably have to weigh in on that. But,
nobody listens to this show. Just our moms.
My freshman year at Oregon, we played, Gladiator, the theme, you know, like the sport.
For the movie. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That was a favorite. We also did, Pirates of the Caribbean my last year. That was another good one. And we only did like
Regulator. Speaking of ERS, that'd have been an amazing one. No, guess not. I would not have made a good Dan Zimmerman or whatever your band director's name was.
Todd Zimmerman.
He is getting a shout out. Todd taught me that the early is to be on time, to be on time is to be late, and to be late is to be dead. Words that I still, I will never forget that, and I never show up late to anything now.
That's the key to success in an HR career, I guess, huh?
Right.
To be late is to be dead.
So are you still drumming, Liz? Do you still do stuff?
I am taking a break from drumming stuff. I actually got into samba, kind of Brazilian style drumming in college, and had a chance to play in a group in Eugene. And then when I moved to Seattle, I played in a group there. And then when I moved to Austin, played in a group here. As about a year ago, I'm taking a little break from music, but it's been great to just be able to keep something like that up, just because marching band and samba have been really just a tremendous way of kind of providing a built-in community when I've moved different places.
So what actual percussion did you play in marching band, and what kind of drums did you play for samba? What were you banging on?
In drumline in college, I played bass one and bass two, which if you look at the bass drum line of a marching band, there are usually five or six different bass drum sizes, and bass one would be the smallest, bass two would be the second smallest. So different years I played those two different drums, and then I played snare drum one year as well. And then samba, I play a drum called the caixa, which is basically a snare drum just with the strings, the snares on the top head rather than on the bottom.
So after you do a marching band performance, where are you sore? Like, where do you feel it the next day? As a drummer.
That's funny. Well, normally your hands and your arms, your forearms, you get really beefy forearms during the season just because you're so used to repetitive motions in your forearms. But really, when you're wearing your drum, you have a lot of weight that you're holding, and your like hip bones, like your pelvis area, yeah, it like bruises and just.
This sounds like really bad sex. Not, sore forearms and a bruised pelvis.
Bruised pelvis.
Teenage boy's dream, though, really. I have another question actually about marching band and college, because they're huge performances. I think of, like, even watching the Southern Grambling football game they do every year, where, like, the incredible marching band performances. And I think about sometimes there's, like, what, 100, 150 members of a marching band? And they go with the football team often in these big college programs. I don't know how any of that works. Do you travel with the football team? Where do you stay? Are you remunerated in any way? Do you have some kind of scholarship help? What do you do about missing classes? All of the practical details I have no idea about, but I'm super curious.
I can speak to what my experience was at Oregon, which was we
all that
had
Nike
about
money, right?
Totally. We went on like one away game a year. So one of the games that happened in like California or Washington per year, we would travel to. And then we always went on the bowl game if the team went to a bowl that year. Mm. Logistically, you know, missing class, it's all on you to make up tests, assignments, whatever. And so if it was a bus trip, everybody'd be like, you know, reading, doing assignments on the bus. We would travel with the cheerleaders normally, which was an interesting experience. They always put us up in the hotel with the cheerleaders, which is a comic mismatch of personality.
Seemed to go. Did you guys make the Rose Bowl when you were there? It seems like that's like the pinnacle of your marching band career.
Yeah, not during any of the years that I was there.
I'm sorry to bring up an old wound. Sorry.
I know. I got some good ones, though. We went to the Holiday Bowl my freshman year, went to the Fiesta Bowl my sophomore year, and then my junior year, I wasn't in the band. I studied abroad. And then my last year, we went to the Sun Bowl in beautiful El Paso, Texas.
Border country.
Ooh, that hurts. That hurts.
Went out with a bang.
Yeah.
So Liz, I pull up, I searched bass drum one, just, I wanted to kind of get a sense of the size, and the pictures showing up are four bass drums, but it's all men playing these drums. I wondered if you could kind of address misogyny and drumming, or the lack of female drummers. Let's just get into that a little bit.
Yeah, I've always thought that's interesting. I mean, like I said, I've played drums and percussion since I was in the sixth grade, so it's just been kind of something that I grew up with and kind of gotten used to being the girl in the boys' club, I guess. But when I tried out for and got a spot on the drumline my freshman year at Oregon, there had not been a female on that drumline for something like 7 or 8 years before I came on. Yeah. Wow. So those guys were not used to, you know, having a girl around, and not that, you know, they behaved any differently because, I mean, they were animals with or without me around. But
it really is like a fraternity, huh?
Oh, totally. I remember one day at band camp, we were like sitting on some artificial turf. Like at the end of the night, it's like 9:30 at night. Everybody's exhausted. We're all getting instructions from our drumline instructor. And one of the guys I was playing on the drumline was, his name is Adam Bretz. I will never forget this moment. He like shushed everybody. He was like, everybody shh. And he lifted a cheek and he went, and he looked at me and he went, Liz, that was for you. And it was kind of their way of initiating me, I guess, into their little world where anything goes, including farting on command on the AstroTurf. So that's just kind of a window into what went on for the next 4 years.
When you were looking at like drummers you really admired, was there a gendered aspect to it? Were you looking for like powerful, badass female drummers? Or were you just kind of like, I like this? Was it the sound that appealed to you?
With drumline, it's a little bit different, like, just because it's so much of a group activity. But okay. In terms of drummers, certainly, you know, you look for female role models, I guess. Sheila E. definitely comes to mind as a badass female drummer. She played with Prince.
You also mentioned having marked your body in some way as a drummer. That's a bad question. I don't know.
I'm
Tell
not
us
sure
about
what
your tattoo.
You're...
I'm like, I don't know how to ask that. So you have a drum tattoo.
Yeah. It's just like a tiny little, I don't know, like a sketch of a drum. It's like a stick drum. Like if you were to draw a stick figure of a human, it would look like a stick drum. And it's actually modeled off of some artwork from a Ben Folds 5 album cover that I got tattooed on the back of my neck when I was like 19. And when people see it, they ask what it is. It's almost always confused for something else. Normally
like
a cupcake. Yep. And so people see it and they go, oh, it's a drum. Are you a drummer? And it's like they're always surprised to hear that I'm a drummer. And I'm thinking, why would I tattoo that onto myself if I weren't? Like, it just, it seems like a question that wouldn't be asked of a male.
No way.
You know?
No way. Yeah.
And maybe I'm wrong on that, but that's the impression I've gotten so far.
I really rocked that question so well.
How you asked that question. It sounds like you have some type of grotesque deformity that looks like a drum with how he asked that question.
All right, I'll do some editing. I will do some editing.
No, it's good. I'm ready. Well, I'm glad you could get into the marching band world a little bit. Is there like rivalries? Was there like rivalries for which bass drum you're going to play? Or were you at rivalries with like the trombones and the drum line? Like you guys butted heads and stuff like that?
Well, I think everybody knows
inter-band rivalries.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I think it's just like with any other activity, there are cliques and rivalries and people who like and dislike each other and things. But I think everybody kind of knew that the drum line was up there in terms of, you know, we're all like the cool guys. The cool guys of the band, if that says anything.
The showstoppers. Without the drum line, the band is just a bunch of tinkling cymbals, really.
And it seems like if anyone's going to get looked down on, it's probably like the clarinets. That's just how I feel. Like flutes, like you can respect it. You know, it's kind of cute sound, but clarinet, like, come on, guys. Play some brass.
It's funny because the woodwinds, generally, flutes and clarinets, and to a lesser degree, like alto saxophone, the instruments that can't really be heard all that well when you're playing on the field, like, you know, they kind of serve as the dating pool for the drum line.
Got it. That makes so much sense now. For those of us who are outsiders to drumline, to marching band culture, or even to drumming, what's one thing that non-drummers fail to understand or just don't get that you feel like you have special insight into as someone who's participated as a drummer?
Oh my gosh. That's a really complex question, but
thank you.
I think marching band in particular is an activity that kind of gets brushed aside as something that's dumb and uncool. And the marching band kids rule the world, man. They're all the cool kids that are in marching band. And I've kept up with tons of people I was in band with in high school and in college, and they're some of the coolest people I know. So make friends with the band geeks.
Yeah, there's a kind of level of commitment, and there's a certain discipline in what you were describing in band camp that I think is pretty exceptional for people of that age. And there's a kind of a commitment to cohesion and a group identity that's pretty beautiful. Like, you're making this enormous sound project together. That's that's pretty awesome, I think.
Yeah, that's what I loved about it.
I think any time, especially in college, you're out on your own for the first time, and you get that sense of community from something somewhere, and that's really important, and that's great. That's a neat thing to carry with you. This is an unrelated question, but does it help with your dance moves? Do you feel like your timing and your drumming helps you be a better dancer?
Oh man, I would hope so. I feel like I have rhythm.
Do you sometimes tie like a heavy circular object in front of you when you go out dancing just so you feel like more natural?
Yeah, usually.
It's whatever, like a barrel, log.
Yep. Whatever helps.
Yeah. All right, Liz, the last thing we want to talk to you about that I feel like you've got real expertise in is, for the last several years, whenever I've thought of like supreme style and real fashion expertise in a legitimate and not a superficial way, I've thought of you, and I've thought of your blog, I've thought of your writing, and I've also thought of your personal self-expression. And so we want to talk, as pretty much idiots in this realm, with you about the difference between fashion and style, and a little bit more on those, both of those concepts. But let's start with that. What's the difference for you between these two concepts?
To me, and I think other people might define this differently, but to me, fashion more explains like the physical objects, the articles of clothing, the lines, the designers that you follow. Fashion is the pieces that you use to express your personal style. I think style is more of an all-encompassing thing that is a language in itself, and that a lot of people just don't either realize or don't give it enough credit for, because it speaks before we do.
Is one or the other more important to you, or are both equally interesting?
I guess as a concept, style might be more important to me, just because that's kind of the language. Fashion is the words that you use to speak style, if you will, to me.
Where did your interest in this begin, and when did you first start writing about fashion style?
Oh man, I have loved clothes and fashion and style since as long as I can remember. Since I was a little kid in elementary school, my parents loved to tell the story that I would pick out my clothes that I wanted to wear the next day, and I would like lay it out on my bedroom floor, complete with all accessories, including socks, my scrunchie, jewelry, shoes, the whole bit. It would all be laid out the night before. And that's the earliest memories I have. So yeah, I've always loved clothes.
I was going to say, I feel like this may have been one of the things that sort of defined that loose network of friends that we belonged to in high school, something of like a idiosyncratic or certainly individually free style sense. I don't think that fashion was something that all of us necessarily identified with, but I think of Jack and you and a lot of the other people that there's something about that personal style that mattered.
Yeah. You know, I have a funny story about Jack Bangeter and fashion or style. So I can't remember what year it was or how this came about, but Jack came upon a bunch of t-shirts through, I don't know how he got these, but they were white t-shirts and they had cartoon action heroes on them, and they all said, "Steel, you know,
be a math action hero."
Right?
I found these with them at the DI and we bought their whole stock.
That was you.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so I'm attributing this to Jack.
No, it's, he helped popularize it for sure.
So yeah, Jack and you were instrumental in getting these to, I think it was our AP calculus class We all had this shirt. So I took this shirt with me, which we wore on like test days, and I remember getting so into these shirts. I took this shirt with me to college, and one night, sophomore year, I went to a party in college, and I was wearing the BMF Action Hero t-shirt, a pair of plaid capris. It was just like a wacky outfit that my roommate and I had put together for me. And somebody at this party pointed at me and looked and was like, "Where did you get that t-shirt?" And I said, "Oh my gosh, my buddy in high school distributed these to our AP calculus class." And he was like, "I know that guy. You know who it was? It was Ben Turner."
No way.
At this party. He was like, "I know that guy." And so the Math Action Hero t-shirt came full circle in Eugene, Oregon.
I am so glad to hear that story, Liz. I had no idea of the life that these shirts took on outside of Miss Peters' AP calculus class, but
they were famous.
Wow. See, that's the kind of style that runs deep in Boise.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's beautiful. If only you guys had Built to Spill on the background, then you'd really understand.
Yes,
the most meta Boise moment. Oh, man.
So, Liz, what's your style now? And do you feel like your style is changing over time? Because me personally, like my style I had at 23, I think I'm just sticking with that. That's all I'm doing the rest of my life.
Are you in cargo shorts right now, Dave? Is that what you're saying?
These are corduroy pants. So I don't know if those are in style now, but this is certainly in style 13 years ago.
They're the winter version of cargo shorts.
And he wears wide whale cargo pants, too. They're not the thin man stuff. With pleats and cuffs.
Oh, man. My style, and I kind of get into a little loose definition on my blog. I would say it's chameleon tomboy chic, which could mean a lot of different things. But
those are three words that we have never heard used in the same sentence before, so you're going to have to unpack it a little bit.
Probably. To me, it means I'll normally choose to be physically comfortable over, you know, looking a certain way.
Good.
And to me, that, yeah, I mean, especially when it comes to footwear, very rarely will I wear high heels. Tomboy, I like kind of a sporty-inspired look anyway. I like bright colors. I like patterns. I like things like that. And then chameleon, you'd asked if my style had changed. I think absolutely it does. At least for me, it's evolved as I've gotten older, and it can evolve day to day also. What I want to wear one day could change the next, and I could be into one thing today that I look at tomorrow and go, "What the hell was I wearing?" So it's that's why it's kind of exciting. That's why I love style and fashion. It's just such a fluid, interesting way of self-expression.
So, important follow-up,
yes.
Which Spice Girl would you most identify yourself with style-wise?
Oh, man. I would think that you would think I'd say sporty, just based on my previous tomboy chic definition.
There's the chameleon aspect to it as well. Sporty is too
favorite,
narrow of a range.
In terms of this, like, aspirational style and fashion, posh. Victoria Beckham is freaking perfection.
It's true. Very classy. We have a couple of totally disinterested questions to ask. We're not asking for anyone in particular, but what style might you expect from your medical provider, say a male nurse in his 30s?
I would hope for something professional. I mean, honestly, if it's a medical provider, I would hope that they're in scrubs.
Like something clean looking, like it's been washed?
Yeah. Yeah, at the very least clean scrubs. And honestly, the nursing profession is the only profession I think Crocs are an appropriate footwear choice. Maybe if you're like a line cook or something, anything where you have to be on your feet a long period of time, but nursing in particular.
What about Keds? Dave, you got any Keds?
I don't. Let's say your medical provider walks in, kind of worn out corduroy, and a plaid shirt that could have been in style in 1998.
In Seattle.
Yeah, how are you feeling? Are you feeling confident?
Huh. Are there any other indicators that he's a medical provider? Like, do you have
He has, like,
ideas?
A pen in his pocket.
Okay.
The stethoscope around the neck.
Oh, nice. That, you do wear
that's
those?
Your universal symbol. Yeah.
Okay. Especially the wide-whaled corduroy pants. Wow, that's hard to say. I don't know. It might make me wonder just how old my medical provider actually was. Because if they are dressing like, you know...
Does not inspire confidence. It really doesn't. You know, I have a dentist who I swear is a teenager. And she looks younger every time I go see her. I feel like she's like the Benjamin Button of dentistry.
Isn't that depressing when medical providers now look to be our age or younger?
Yeah, I keep thinking every time I go in for like a teeth cleaning, they're going to put me to sleep and like extract my teeth or something for some kind of experiment. I think it's – I'm just waiting for the medical malpractice stuff to happen.
My dentist I went to last week was legitimately wearing cargo shorts when I saw him. And that did just occur to me. He did a great job. He's in his 60s. I love the guy.
This guy doesn't take insurance. He lives under a bridge and he uses plywood. Those are the other three facts you need to know about him.
Not even cargo pants, but cargo shorts. Even be bothered to cover his lower leg. Oh, wow.
Were they camouflage, like desert camouflage?
No, it's nice, a nice khaki cargo short. They're very classy.
Chinos. Another, of course.
This is another just kind of out of left field question. What would you want to see from – what kind of style would you want to see from a struggling poet? What would you expect? What do you think would help a struggling poet?
Struggling poet.
You know, one that's been in grad school for half of their life maybe.
Right. I mean, are you owning the struggle? Are you wanting to –
That's the most important question you ask in a struggling poet.
If you want to look like you're owning the struggle, you gotta, you know, thrift shops and maybe those old wide-wheeled corduroy pants. Put a beret on it. Just call it a day.
Tie a loose piece of hempen rope around your waist to keep them sort of the shapeless bit of linen I've gathered from the docks.
Right. Although then you're kind of stepping into Brooklyn hipster territory, so.
Yeah, I contain multitudes, though, Liz. I really do.
Yeah.
I also wanted to say one of the things I feel most grateful for, I use this in conversation. It's one of my favorite terms. You introduced me through your blogging to the term bodity, which I absolutely love. What is a bodity, and what's your bodity?
So bodity is bodily oddity, which is just something weird that you notice about your own body. And for me, I noticed years and years ago that my feet are a lot bigger than I think my height would suggest. So I'm 5'6", which is average height for a female. And my shoe size is around a 9.5-10 for women. That's not men. So the men, that would be like
7.5-8.
Yeah, 8.5-ish.
That's what I wear.
But I have friends who are like a good 4 to 6 inches taller than me who I have the same shoe size. And I'm thinking, did I just like stop growing at a certain point? Like, was I meant to be taller and just never quite got there? Or are my feet just freakishly big? So that's my bodily body.
I feel like for me, when I was in England, this was really driven home to me. I would go to buy a pair of jeans or buy a pair of pants and they would fit around the waist just fine. But my thighs were like probably 8 inches too wide in the circumference. I could not fit my thighs into European men's pants. I felt always so embarrassed. I'm like, no, the waist would fit. I just can't get them over my thighs. It made me feel like I had like embarrassingly like troll shaped thighs.
Oh no. Yeah. It's
so the cargo short is my pant of choice now because of my tree trunk thighs.
Relegated to the cargo.
My leg is the cargo. Two final questions for you. One is another super distinctive thing, Liz. You've been, I think, very brave in changing hairstyles. Dave has this theory that each person not only picks their fashion sense at a certain point in their life, but they arrive at their haircut. I don't know, Dave, could you expand a bit on this theory and then run it by Liz, see what she thinks?
No, I think the truly lucky, they find it at age 6. Hair is not something they have to consider again, ever. And it's a beautiful thing. I remember being about 12 thinking like, I don't think the bowl cut's it. I don't think this is going to cut it for the rest of my life. I looked around at some of the other 12-year-olds, and I think he's got it. That's his haircut. He's got it for the rest of his life. And so it's something that I've always strived for, and I think I'm there, but I mean, right now it's a buzz cut, but it's just always some stage of the same haircut, whether long or short. So I'm pretty happy.
I can certainly appreciate that. Having arrived at your haircut and just deciding that's it, you're going with it, not deviating from that plan. I think there's value in that, but I think there might be, it's different for guys and girls. Because girls, you know, we just generally deal with more hair. And I did up until about a year and a half ago. So I have just naturally very curly hair. I've had it different lengths, but for the longest time I had it pretty long. And dealing with it just is, as anybody with naturally curly hair that is long will understand, it's a chore. You can't just brush through it. You have to wash it, redo it, redry it. It's a time-consuming endeavor. And I had always been curious about shaving my head, just, you know, what that would feel like and what that would look like. And just, you know, I'm just a curious person in general. And so I'll be the one.
Were you worried about your head shape underneath, or did you have a sense like?
Oh, totally. There's no way to know until it's done.
Until you do it.
there's no way of knowing. And
were
so
you like feeling it, palpating, like being like, I think there's no weird bumps, but you.
Yeah. I thought, well, you know, my hat size isn't super big, so maybe there won't be anything like too grotesque to uncover there. But about a year and a half ago, the company I was working for, we had an employee whose son got cancer. And so a small group of us decided to shave our heads for St. Baldrick's, which is an organization that raises money for children's cancer research. And so I decided, well, that's as good an excuse as any to just do it. And so with my employer's blessing, which is really the biggest thing I was worried about was, you know, can I show up to work with a shaved head? I did it. And since then, I've reshaved it down a couple of times. Just like I'll go into the barber shop and say, just do the number 2 all the way around. And that's what they do. Since then, I've shaved it down a couple of times, but now it's like kind of a shortish, like edging on pixie type look. And honestly, I don't know if I'll ever grow it out long again. So
that's
I may have arrived at my haircut at 34, I think.
There's a little part of me that's a tiny bit sad and jealous, Liz, because this is a secret, but I've always been super jealous and envious of people with really naturally curly hair. Like,
really?
I would see like pictures of dudes with perms like in the 90s and be like, oh man, if I had curly hair, I'd grow it so huge. I wish I had like a Jewish afro, you know?
It's kind of the grass is greener.
It really is. I know.
Totally. And every girl with naturally curly hair wants straight hair. Just to not have to do it.
Just the pressure.
Yeah.
All right. Last question for you. 3 fashion tips for today's man. I think we've touched on one of them. We probably know where we're going to head with one of them. But give us Liz's 3 professional tips for today's man.
All right. If I can only give 3.
Yep.
Number 1, I would say find a good tailor and don't be afraid to use their services because especially with men's clothes, things don't fit off the rack a lot. So don't be afraid to buy things, you know, especially if you buy things a little bit cheaper, if you buy things on sale that don't quite fit. Buy them cheaper and then have them tailored to fit you. They will look that much more expensive and slick if you just have it tailored. Or have things custom made. There's all sorts of like services and companies out there now where you just send in your measurements and you have custom made dress shirts. So tailored clothes or bespoke, if you will, clothing is your friend.
Okay. Pro tip number 1 was get a professional. Make sure your clothes fit, you slovenly man. Number 2.
Number 2 is less is more. A lot of men's clothing now I see with all these unnecessary bells and whistles on them. And I'm not sure if this is just having to do with women's clothing, having that going on a lot. There's a lot of like embellishments on jean pockets.
Zippers.
Zippers sequins. And weird, distressing zippers, glitter, rivets and like studs that don't like, it cheapens the garment. It makes it look cheap and dated. So I would say, don't get things with weird front pleats because that's unbelievably unflattering.
But you're in favor of the back pleat. You like the pleats around the buttock.
I think same policy with the back pleat.
Oh,
just
okay.
any kind of any kind of extra pleat detailing, just say no. Less is more.
Okay. Because I've been a huge fan of these, the t-shirts. It's probably a little bit out of style now. Like the black t-shirt with like the fancy gold stuff all over them. It looks like you're way into watching UFC. Those are really cool.
The Affliction shirts?
Yes. Yeah. Those are great.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Unless you want to look. Yeah. That's just like it's like a wife beater look. I don't know how else to say it. Like it's just a very like, I don't know.
Handsome man making good choices.
So, I mean, I don't know what you think of this, Liz, but like I've been just saying, go to your local county fair for inspiration. That's where I pick up my most recent fashion advice. And I would say it works wherever you're – I mean, no matter whether you're in an urban or a rural state, head to the county fair, look at the kind of people you see showing animals, and just copy their look. Or the vendors. Go to the vendors.
All I can say is no good life decision has ever been made in an Ed Hardy or an Affliction t-shirt.
Words of wisdom.
We might not even tap out.
We might not even need book wisdom this week. All right, number three. This one's going to be obvious for people who've been paying attention, but we need to say it out loud anyway.
No cargo shorts. Guys, I know they're comfortable. I get it. We ladies have our own equivalent of cargo shorts. We have yoga pants, which we wear to yoga. But cargo shorts, man, it just, to me, it just harkens back to my days at Timberline High School when Abercrombie and Fitch was all the rage and all the 17-year-old boys were running around in these huge shorts with these huge pockets. And the thing is, these guys, like that article was saying, a lot of guys just never get rid of their clothes. It just sticks with you.
But Liz, where are you going to put all your cargo? Like, what if I don't have my pockets, where am I putting my cargo?
Well, this is what I want to know. What are you hauling around? Like, what's...
Lanyards, 40-key keychain sets. I see a lot of those with guys. Guys, like, have a lanyard and, like, 17 keys hanging out of their pocket, and I know there's at least 30 more keys in the pocket.
Like a janitor? Yeah. Like a high school janitor?
I mean, they're not a high school janitor, but they have the keychain of one.
Right. I just see the thing is a lot of guys I know don't carry around anything more than like a wallet or a money clip and their cell phone. Yeah. So why do you need cargo shorts?
In case.
I mean, the pockets on the sides, I'm telling you, it just creates this unflattering silhouette and makes you look
like
that
penguin.
Much
bigger. Like a penguin.
Totally. Like a junior high penguin.
Next you're going to come out against the carpenter gene. I mean, where am I supposed to put my hammer?
Yeah.
Oh, man, the carpenter gene. That loop.
Yeah, it's such an important accessory. It's like a hand. Yeah, anyway. So thank you, Liz. You've been an amazing expert testifier. The thing that we need to move on to now, we've got 2 segments to wrap up the show. The first we're very excited about because we're going to be talking about drums and drum music. It is Unchained Melodies. Each week we play several songs on a theme, and this week the theme is the best use of drums or songs that you wish a marching band would play. Hitting close to home. Dave, you want to start us off? What are we going to listen to first?
I do. As soon as I hear drum, I think the song Heavy Metal Drummer by Wilco. Jeff Tweedy wrote this song when he fired their old drummer, and he got just a really world-class drummer to join Wilco. He was so inspired that he had to write this song.
Shiny pants and bleached blonde hair. A double kick drum by the river in the summer. She fell in love with the drummer. Another than another, she fell in love. I miss the innocence I've known. Playing kiss covers, beautiful and stone.
That's a cautionary style tale right there, the glitter pants or whatever he was wearing in that. I mean, watch out.
It's okay if you're a drummer, though. You wear whatever you need to.
All right, my choice. This is a song by the drummer on this is the great Clyde Stubblefield. I picked this song because since the 1970s, Clyde Stubblefield has lived in Madison, Wisconsin. He's considered the most sampled drummer of all time, but he's basically lived in poverty because James Brown took all the royalties and rights to the music, and Clyde's got nothing. But he is the original Funky Drummer, and this is Funky Drummer by James Brown with Clyde Stubblefield on the drums.
And go up.
Still with James Brown and the Funky Drummer. Liz, you're our drum expert. What song should we play next?
Well, I feel now like my picks weren't as cerebral as what the two of them chose.
It's hard to keep up with us. We're very cerebral.
We want primal. We want drum energy. We want passion. Whatever you got.
That's what I went with. So I went with two songs that I liked their use of drums, and then I would also love to see a marching band play. My first pick, Formation by Beyonce, has a sick bass beat during the chorus, and like as you hear it going into the chorus, you can catch like a little marching snare lick as she leads into the chorus. So there's some kind of callback to marching band in that too. And I thought this was just current and appropriate, and I like the song, so.
Such a sophisticated use of music terminology. We're going to have to replay that segment and figure out what all those words meant, but I'm impressed. Here we go. Beyonce, Formation.
Y'all haters corny with that Illuminati mess. Paparazzi, catch my fly and my cocky fresh. I'm so reckless when I rock my Givenchy dress. I'm so possessive, so I rock his rock necklaces. My daddy Alabama, mama Louisiana. You mix that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas Bama. I got hot sauce in my bag. Swag.
Ooh, yeah, baby. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I like that.
I did not come to play with you hoes.
I love it when someone comes on and plays like a genuinely popular song that I've never heard before. Because like I always enjoy it, but I've never heard that song before. But the whole time, like, wow, this Beyonce, she's really something. She's good at this, isn't she?
This is, my wife never watches videos, ever. She emailed me at work when this record came out. She's like, Steele, I watched the video. And she used like 17 exclamation marks. And she'd watched Beyonce's Formation. She was like on fire. She's like, we need to buy this album. And so we bought it and we listened to it all the time. And so Cedar, our son, our two-year-old, is a huge fan. And the other day, the babysitter came over, and they're eating dinner. He's eating dinner, and all of a sudden, he looks up from his, like, pasta, and he goes, Megan, do you like Beyonce? And I don't think Laurel's ever been as proud of our son to hear that story afterwards. So.
Aww.
Yeah, that's an amazing record and a great song. I never noticed that kind of drum. That would be an amazing marching band kind of performance, especially at, like, a historically black college university.
I'm sure if it's not already in the works, somebody's going to do it.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
All right, so my second choice. This is by the drummer on this track is Tony Allen. He's the kind of acknowledged as the inventor of Afrobeat. Tremendously talented guy. He was capable, I guess, of playing four different rhythms with his four different limbs. I don't know if you're going to hear that on this song because I'm not a drum nerd or drum aficionado in the same way. But this is a song called Rofo Rofo Fight by Fela Kuti.
From Abeokuta City.
Translation to original English.
So, interesting fact that he also, professional basketball player, won the championship with the NBA, the Celtics, 2008.
Great defender. Tenacious defense. Tony Allen, great defender. I mean, same name, but different guy, actually, Dave.
Unfortunate.
I don't know any of the technical language, but he sounds like he's really good. I'm hoping that was your experience, too, Liz. I don't know.
So, I immediately, as soon as I saw that we were doing this segment, I thought of when Radiohead went on the Grammys and they actually played a great song. They actually got a drum line up there with them to play this song off their In Rainbows album.
15 Step?
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay. So I didn't know about that performance, but how awesome would it be if you were in a drum line and Radiohead's like, hey, do you want to play in the Grammys with us?
Yeah. What we all dream of.
So what's the story, Dave? Do you know who these kids are or how they got picked for this or any of that?
I don't. I just know that Tom or the Radiohead dudes had this idea. It's a great, really danceable, fun song, and it's got some great drum beats, so they just wanted to have a drum line. So I think it was just a local college in California. They found them and they just played together, and it's super fun video to watch. It seems like if I was in a drum line, that would be my greatest dream come true. And I could never be in a drum line because I cannot keep a beat whatsoever.
That explains Dave's great love for Built to Spill, by the way, Liz, just so you know. They don't have a rhythm section so much as an irrhythm section. But all right, Liz, finish us off with a great drum track that you would love a marching band to play.
Okay, my second pick is a song that I genuinely love. I love this song. The opening drum lick is just so sweet, and the drums are awesome throughout. Van Halen's Hot for Teacher.
Great message, too. Really great message.
Absolutely.
Choice, Liz. That's one of those few songs that, legitimately gets much worse when they start singing.
Right?
Yeah.
I can't believe that song is over 30 years old. 32 years old, actually. It came out on 1984, their album.
I think of Van Halen as like this iconic guitar sound, but it was cool how that song waits like a full 30 seconds before you even hear the first. It's just drums for the opening 30 seconds. I can see how that would appeal to a young drummer.
Yeah, yeah. It's still a sweet song. It has stood the test of time.
Absolutely. I wonder what the teacher is going to look like this year. Yeah!
Isn't it funny how at the time that was so subversive, you know?
Oh, my goodness.
And now it's just, that's nothing.
Yeah, it's hardly explicit. Enough for our taste. Well, Liz, the time has flown by. It's almost come time for us to say good evening for this episode. But the thing we love to end with is a segment we call Book Wisdom, where we share a passage from a work of literature, a book that's been particularly meaningful to us. And this week, the honor is all yours.
Cool. So I typically read a lot of nonfiction in general. And lately, I've been reading a lot of books about writing style, how to write better, what to look for when you're reading, things like that. And recently I read Stephen King's book on writing, where he actually delves into kind of the details of his process and the stories behind some of his most famous novels, which are really interesting. But just listening to him in my head talk about his own writing was really interesting to me. And this particular passage from his book on writing, I really enjoyed. And it says, "Writing is magic, as much the water of life as any other creative art. The water is free, so drink. Drink and be filled up." I like that.
That is great. Writing is as much the water of life as any other creative art. That's something worth remembering for sure.
Yeah, I think that just kind of talks to the excitement of creativity, of creating something. It's really fun just to tell stories to my kids. And writing, just to create something new and put it down in words, just that alone is fun without even necessarily having to have someone else read it. And it's really empowering.
Thanks, Liz. You've been great. We appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, guys. This has been fun.
Awesome. Off the chain. It's off the chain.
I don't do laundry ever. I can't do it.
Too complicated? Short arms? T-Rex arms get in the way?
You joke, but once you get to 5 kids, it's extremely complicated still. I don't know what clothes go to what kid.
That's, wow. You've got your hands full.
And his feet and other appendages. They're all full.
Yeah, I carry them in my teeth sometimes, like big cats. They do that, huh?
That was Dave's nickname in college. We all called him Big Cat.
Really?
No, not at all. That's the last thing we're going to call him in college.